Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
If you've been waiting a long time for a package to arrive or been shaking your head at the delay in being able to pick up the car you ordered, not weeks, but months and months ago, you can most likely blame COVID-19 and the supply chain crisis that it set off around the world. First off, it was toilet paper, of course, although maybe that was just because of panic buying, but supply chain shortages have crept right across the economy. They're everywhere, with many Australian retailers struggling to get goods to consumers or onto the shelves. And, gee, I didn't even want to raise the issue of parcel deliveries or the postal service. Why has COVID-19 meant that certain brands of alcohol might not be on sale this Christmas, for example, or that the bike you wanted to buy just might not be available? Not because it's not made anymore, because no one can find a ship or a truck or a container to deliver it. To delve into the world of supply chains, logistics, shipping, and how it's all affecting you, I've got two great guests with me tonight. First up, Professor Michael Bell is the Chair of Ports and Maritime Logistics at the Institute of Transport and Logistics Studies, the University of Sydney Business School, and he's with us, hooray, in the studio here as a real live guest too. Michael, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thank you. Yeah.
And Fleur Brown is the Chief Industry Affairs Officer for the Australian Retailers Association, and Fleur joins us as well. Fleur, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening. Good evening, Fleur.
Great to have both of you with us. It's quite a drama, isn't it? Fleur, can we start with you? Can you paint a picture of what kinds of shortages are being faced across Australia and what products are being hit hard?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, first, I just have to say toilet paper blues, what a blast from the past. That seems like such a nice problem to have.
it was tough there at the time. I remember one Sunday afternoon and a service station I was driving past had a sign out the front, not saying unleaded at a phenomenal price. They had a sign written in blackboard saying, "We've got toilet paper," and there was a queue of people.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, unfortunately for retail staff, that was just the beginning of, you know, the customer aggression side of things, which has plagued us through the pandemic as well. So, of course, yes, it has been 2 years of these challenges, and I will paint the picture, but first, I guess, to say that retailers have sort of been anticipating that they didn't have a crystal ball around how long the pandemic would last. Nobody did, but they were anticipating that supply chain challenges would hit us pretty hard this Christmas. And so they've been planning for many, many months to try and avert the crisis as much as they can. But it is finding its way through into, you know, absolutely everything. Of course, at Christmas time, food is very much a focus, and even last year, last Christmas, we were telling customers to get in and order early for, you know, if it's a particular type of meat that they were wanting for Christmas, or, you know, whatever there was on their menu, to really think it through and see what they could get ahead of time, because there would be some patience and some supply chain challenges necessary at that time. So the food is very much an issue, meat in particular. So meat, the price has gone up significantly. There's a range of factors there. If you're looking at, of course, on the gift side, electronics, so there's a global shortage of computer chips affecting production of things like computers and phones currently. And of course, there's also that sort of high demand and slow supply from offshore of some of those products as well. So you really don't want to be disappointed in getting those orders in. It's really not something you can get as a last minute gift option for Christmas. Clothing is affected, particularly out of China. So it's across the board, really. And we have had a little, I guess, a surprise this week around the shortage of urea and AdBlue, which I could not have told you what that was.
AdBlue is a fuel for transport, isn't it?
That's right, a couple of days ago. But that's now the latest challenge that will potentially not affect the Christmas supply chain, but certainly is threatening some transportation post-Christmas. So there are many challenges for retailers at this time, you know, on top of staff shortages, which they also face, which are also, of course, affecting distribution.
Mm. Yes, my texter says, we'll get to this. I don't want to jump right into this problem straight away, but adding to our problems, we do not like to make anything here and we get it all from overseas. We're so close. Well, I guess that's true too. Phil, please ask about pallet shortages in Australia too. That's a thing as well, isn't it, Fleur?
It is. It is. And, you know, again,
this is silly. They're just wooden things. I mean, like heaven's sake, well, how can there be a shortage of pallets?
I know. If you can have toilet paper moguls, you can surely have pallet moguls as well. It's a real thing, and it's, you know, there's an issue globally. So of course Australia's not alone in this. We've talked to our counterparts in the UK and the US, and they are facing identical issues. There's not enough ships. There's not enough pallets. We saw an announcement today by Qantas in collaboration with Australia Post to convert their Airbuses to freight planes to try and address the shipping issue. But, it's really a symptom of just too many things in the ports. And that's why we're projecting out to about 2023. These issues are not going to be solved overnight, that's for sure.
Wow. Michael, can we go back to March last year? As the world cascaded into lockdown, is it possible to pinpoint the start of the problems here? Because, I mean, see, an outside observer might say, well, what's the problem here? There are ships, there are pallets. I mean, get moving. And in fact, this must present an unprecedented market opportunity for transport and logistics chains companies. I mean, they ought to be reveling in this, but they don't seem to be.
Yeah, well, actually, the first comment I'd like to make is that you talked about Fleur talked about averting the crisis and ordering early. That really just stokes the problem, because that stokes demand. People are ordering things with longer lead times, and all of that just adds to the problem. But
how did it start? I mean, the pandemic hit. Everyone thought, oh, well, there's going to be a massive recession.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of companies thought, we'd better take some preventative action. Yeah. But apparently shipping companies did too. And they thought, well, there's going to be less demand. So did they put less ships on? There was some talk that they made them sail more slowly.
Exactly. They did two things. They started sailing more slowly.
Why?
And, if you don't have the demand for your ships, for example, if you were to halve the sailing speed of ships, you'd halve the capacity of ships. So if you only had half the demand for ships, you would fill up your ships by sailing at half the speed. So that's one thing. And the other thing, of course, was that a lot of shipping lines started cancelling sailings or blanking sailings, which was very disruptive. So in those two, so you can divide 2020 into two halves. So the first half was the period when the shipping lines thought they were in big trouble and they were trying to manage what they thought would be an enduring reduction in demand. But then what transpired was that after the initial lockdowns, people had saved, people weren't spending on holidays and leisure, they weren't spending on services, and instead they spent it on containerized products. So there was a huge bounce back of demand for containerized products, more than the shipping lines were expecting. Added to that was the fact that supply chains basically slowed down. They literally slowed down. We've talked about ships going more slowly, but ships were spending longer times in ports because of congestion. And so basically the whole supply chain has slowed down and got less reliable, which is why things are in short supply, taking longer to turn up and so on.
There's also, explain how apparently the shipping companies, because it's not as competitive out there as you may think among shipping companies. There are some big operators. They also decided to kind of work together to decrease shipping in the initial months of the lockdown. There are three big alliances, I understand.
Exactly.
Explain how that worked.
Yes, so there are alliances in container shipping in the same way as there are alliances in air travel. So you'll be, I think most of your listeners will be aware of Star Alliance and so on. Container shipping does the same thing. So there are three large alliances who are very good at managing capacity. So what they did after the initial lockdowns was basically collude in reducing the number of sailings. So they basically blanked sailings. So there is, I think, a genuine concern about the level of competition that exists in container shipping. And as you say, there's some very big players there. In fact, the 10 largest container shipping lines basically dominate over 80% of the market. So it's a very consolidated industry.
Mm. There were also changes, weren't there, in where ships were headed, for example. I mean, for example, surgical masks were being sent from China to Africa, which isn't usually a popular route, and that left shipping containers waiting to come back. Now, explain why there's a worldwide shortage at the moment. There seems to be some crisis in shipping containers.
Well,
why on earth would there be? I mean, they haven't all fallen off the ship. They haven't sunk. No, they're all there. No. What's happened?
Now, well, what's happened, basically, is that supply chains have slowed down. So this means that to move the same quantity of goods, in fact, to move slightly less goods, you need more containers and more ships because they're going more slowly. A lot of the slowness is to do with congestion in ports, both on the land side and on the water side. So basically, containers and ships are not as productive as they normally would be.
Mm. Yeah. With containers, for example, I mean, Australia doesn't make a lot of things. We export a lot of stuff, but we export a lot of bulk things. So we export minerals and coal and iron ore and grain and so on, and a lot of our wealth comes from that. But we don't export a lot of things anyway that are manufactured and put in cardboard boxes and put into containers. So when all those containers come from overseas full of bibs and bobs, do they go back empty, do they?
About half of them do, yeah. So about half of the containers leaving Port Botany are in fact empty. The imbalances are actually not just in terms of trade flows, but also in terms of what's in the containers. So a lot of what Australia imports comes in 40-foot containers, whereas what we do export tends to be quite dense, like wine bottles, and you can only put them in 20-foot containers. So there are imbalances throughout the industry, which means you have to reposition a lot of empty containers.
but this has kind of always been the case, isn't it? I mean, that's what's puzzling at the moment. Well, yeah, you can describe these problems, but these problems have always been the case. So you know, why now? Are you saying that there is some collusion between the shipping companies to actually, are they on a deliberate go slow? Because they presumably must be making a fortune at the moment, aren't they?
Container shipping lines have never been more profitable. I mean, they're making fantastic profits, which I have to say, if things are done sensibly, would be a good thing, because shipping is having to think about how to go carbon neutral, and that's going to cost a lot. And now they've got the money to do it. So let's hope that they make the investments that they need to go carbon neutral.
That's interesting. Michael Bell is a professor. He's chair of Ports and Marine Logistics at the University of Sydney Business School. With us also, Fleur Brown from the Australian Retailers Association is also here in the studio with us. Fleur, can we actually, Jen on the text line says shipping containers sound a bit like petrol prices. There's collusion between big players. Well, I mean, is that fair, Michael? They're probably, what you're saying, that sounds true.
I think it is. I mean, essentially, because the alliances can manage capacity, it means they can ration the supply of empty containers to exporters, principally in China. Mm. So there is, I think, potential for a dysfunctional market.
Speaking of dysfunctional markets, Sam from Aberfoyle Park in South Australia says, I looked at buying a 40-foot high second-hand shipping container. I don't think you mean 40-foot high. You mean a 40-foot second-hand shipping container for storage less than a year ago. The going price then was $2,500. It's now tripled.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fleur, back to you on this, because a bit as Michael described that shipping companies thought, oh, well, there's going to be, you know, we're heading into a big recession. Things are going to be grim for a while. We better try and, you know, get in early on this. Was there, in a sense, there was a bit like that in the retail industry too, wasn't there? There was a feeling, because economists were predicting a recession all around. But in fact, the reverse seems to have happened. People went home and, because they couldn't go out, started to online shop.
Yeah, well, look, I think we've definitely learned the power of that domestic spend, you know, that might have been diverted to international travel. And, you know, that's been a real saviour for the retail sector, that's for sure. I think it's important to not view retail as one bunch, I guess. You've got a lot of winners and losers within the retail community. So, you know, some of the essential, what we call essential retail, you know, has done fairly well through the pandemic, particularly household goods, you know, food, essential goods in that sort of category, anything to do with nesting, that they've all performed really well through the pandemic. But of course, there are losers, and that amongst them would be what we call discretionary retail, particularly clothing. So fashion and clothing, it doesn't take much imagination to see why that's occurred. You know, you've got half dressing for Zoom and people not going into the office, and, you know, that kind of slowdown for the clothing and fashion sector has been a bit disastrous. Also, CBD retail has really suffered because of the lack of office workers. So there were winners and losers. It's not one size fits all, but certainly some categories of retail have performed really well. I just want to add a point to what you were talking about previously on the shipping side of things. The ACCC report that came out recently showed that the freight rates on key global trade routes are currently about seven times higher than they were just a year ago.
Seven times. So someone, I mean, Michael, they're massively gouging, aren't they? Because their costs haven't gone, their costs haven't increased like that.
No, they're making huge profits.
Yeah.
I like your idea of diverting that into sustainability practice.
A couple of texters have asked this. They said, you know, what's stopping more competitors coming in? I mean, or is it a shipping a closed shop, Michael?
It's not a closed shop, but of course it needs a lot of investment to buy a ship, particularly now, because
don't you just charter them?
Well, if you can find one. But there are no ships to charter at the moment. They're all in high demand. The thing is that if you slow supply chains down, which is effectively what's happened, mainly because of congestion in ports, then, of course, you need more containers and more ships to do the same amount of work. So that's why there's a shortage of ships.
Someone was saying, I can't recall who it was, perhaps it was you, Michael, even, that every ship in the world is currently deployed. So,
But what are they doing, Fleur, if they're all deployed?
Well, they're sitting in congestion in ports.
Well, is that the issue? Is that the issue, Michael? Let's talk about ports, for example. I know there is congestion at Chinese ports. Is that part of the problem, that ships are having trouble loading and unloading?
Well, there is a pandemic-related issue with, you know, worker availability and ports not being as productive as they would normally be. But I think it's the surge in demand has caused congestion, which has slowed down shipping, which has there's a vicious circle there, which is basically feeding on itself. And so it's going to be difficult to get out of it, I think. And as has been mentioned, we don't expect to be out of it until 2023.
Yeah, because, Fleur, it's not as though the transport industry in that sense is, I mean, has it been affected by COVID particularly? Because it's not as though if you're working in the transport industry, in the shipping industry at least, anyway.
Yes, absolutely. Look, you know, the staff shortages that we've mentioned a couple of times are acute. We're short 700,000 overseas workers for a start. 15% of those work in retail, you know, general retail. So that has a flow-on effect to every area of retail, including drivers, you know, freight, transportation, those kinds of logistics. So that absolutely does affect transportation challenges. And you've also got, you know, on a very minor level, you've got some of those staff also affected by border restrictions, and, you know, potentially there is a percentage of them who are not vaccinated, who are unable to work in certain situations, and that takes even more staff off the market. So the staff shortages are really one of the highest factors there.
Yes, Michael, go on.
Just to add to that, it hasn't received a lot of publicity, but China's been pursuing a policy of, if there's one case, close the terminal. So there's been quite a lot of disruption in China, basically getting the exports out.
I don't want to be cynical here, Michael, but is there a chance that the shipping companies don't really want things to get back to normal all that quickly? Because if shipping rates have gone up seven times, there's not much incentive on them to improve, is there?
Well, that's what I mean by a dysfunctional market. I mean, there are some perverse incentives in there. And basically, shipping lines are profiting from container terminals not working very well. So.
Fleur, is this supply chain thing, I mean, it's not just shipping, is it? You know, if I open the line to truckies, they'll tell me there are the same issues here in the sense of...
Yeah, of course.
Of getting goods from port, you know, to warehouses, to retail outlets.
Yeah, absolutely.
All those supply chains are really under huge stress. Tell me about that.
Yeah, they are, absolutely. And look, also, you've got the other issue here is that, of course, warehouses are under a lot more pressure because of the online surge. So during lockdowns and even outside of lockdowns, we've seen enormous growth in that kind of, you know, click and collect pack, you know, from the warehouse. Quite often, a lot of what we learned through the first lockdowns is that a lot of that activity was happening out of Victoria, more than people probably anticipated. And, of course, there were some border restrictions there. And then you had whole warehouses having to close down or entire shifts were taken out of the workforce because there were COVID cases. And, of course, that had a flow-on effect as well. So it's the distribution centres as well, as well as the drivers, as well as the border restrictions, you know, all of those things come into play here, not just the ships and the flight.
Fleur, tell us about someone, we were discussing this topic in preparing the program. Someone said, yes, but also there's also the way that modern retailers use warehousing these days. But one of the things you don't want to be if you're a retailer is to be stuck with great warehouses of unsold goods that you hope to sell sometime in the future, because you're bearing the cost of having bought them and having them sit in the warehouse. There's a modern warehousing is all built around the idea of just in time. That is, if people buy things, you want to have one of them available now. If someone buys one tomorrow you'll have another one. To put it simply, is that system also contributing to these delays?
Look, absolutely. I think you know, there's a range of things in the distribution centres, courtesy of all of this growth that we've seen in people's new requirements. You know, the way that they're shopping and the demand for getting things that they want faster, quicker, etc. All of that sort of creates a perfect storm of issues, I think, when it comes to some of the transportation logistics. Of course, you've got things like returns as well, which clutter up the distribution channels. So as you increase online sales, of course, you increase the volume of returns because people, if you look at clothing or shoes, for example, people are not trying them on in store when they're ordering them. And so you've got quite a high returns issue there, which then creates more transport and delivery logistics as well.
My texter says, Phil, there are currently over 200 container ships backed up outside Los Angeles. The demurrage charges are creating a cost increase of goods which has to be recovered by product price increases. Who bears the cost of all that, Michael, if a ship's waiting to get into port?
Well,
I mean, if I contract to ship something to the United States, you give me a price.
Yeah.
If you don't arrive till 3 weeks after you said you would, who bears the cost of that?
Well, there have been some arguments between cargo owners and shipping lines about what happens if a container spends too long in a port. There's demurrage charges that usually get passed on to the cargo owner. But cargo owners, of course, quite rightly, are arguing that if the ship turned up late and other factors prevented them from collecting the container on time, why should they pay demurrage? So the... basically, it's a cargo owner, but it seems unfair on the current situation. So there's a feeling that at the moment the balance of power is with shipping lines, and the risk is that they behave in ways that are not at the cost of cargo owners, one could put it.
Ron's called in. He's a motor mechanic. Just back on your point at the beginning of the program, Fleur. Ron says most big new trucks use AdBlue. That's the fuel. He says there's a massive shortage at the moment. What does Michael think about that?
To be honest, I mean, I have read about this issue, but I don't know where AdBlue comes from. So I don't, does it come in containers? I don't know.
Well, it doesn't come in containers.
From China is the issue, and they've cut off the, I think 80% of the supply comes from China.
It's not a fuel, apparently. It's an additive. Okay.
It's an additive. More than 50% of Australian diesel fleet requires the AdBlue additive to operate, which is pretty...
It's about emissions, apparently. It's because of emissions, yeah. Brett's a truckie. He says, AdBlue is not a fuel, it's an additive. It's injected into the exhaust to help reduce emissions. It's not something that can be legally switched off. And for Cummins engines, at least the engine will only provide full power for around 1,500 kilometres without AdBlue if it runs out or the system fails before the engine is derated. The vast majority of new heavy vehicles sold in around the last 8 to 10 years need AdBlue. Without it, they'll be getting parked up.
Yes, so that's the latest, greatest pandemic problem. Unfortunately, we're looking at the Australian government, the federal government's very engaged in this. There's a big powwow on that in the morning, and should hopefully shed some light on what some of the solutions might be. But it is an issue.
It just goes to show how fragile and exposed we are, you know, really, doesn't it? I mean, Janie and Hawthorne, just can we talk about drivers a bit more, Fleur, too? And Reddings, Phil says, Janie, Reddings is a big independent books chain of Melbourne bookstores. They've got 5 tonnes of books waiting for drivers in warehouses right now. There is a shortage of drivers, isn't there?
Well, there's a shortage of, you know, staff across the board, and I think obviously in that sort of situation, some staff, you know, might have moved on from their previous jobs because they've had, you know, better offers, or they want to do different work now. And that, you know, that has a flow-on effect. So until we start getting some of those overseas workers back in the country, I think we're going to be quite severely challenged in this area. And that is something, again, the federal government's looking at, you know, very closely, are trying to prioritise this. They understand the impacts, but it doesn't help the immediate issue.
It does go to show, Michael, doesn't it, like how extraordinarily fragile we are. I mean, we've discussed, for example, in the past how fragile and how exposed Australia is on the fuel front generally, that, you know, there's no national fuel reserve, and here we are. We're seeing trucks in Australia curtailed in the amount they can work because of this additive, which we don't make, and which comes from one source.
Indeed. So, absolutely. And I'd be interested to hear from Fleur to what extent retailers are considering, instead of sourcing from overseas and, you know, running the risk of delays through ships not turning up on time, etc., but sourcing more locally. And is this feasible, and what sort of products would it be feasible for, and is it being thought about in retail?
Everything would have been on the table in the last 12 months around supply chain, and if there were local provisions available of anything that was in short supply, it would have been considered, absolutely. I think, you know, the reality is with you know, certain categories, you know, whether it's clothing or certain types of food, there isn't, you know, a high local supply of those things. Again, computer, electronics, etc. I mean, we're probably all conscious of how long it takes to develop those sorts of manufacturing provisions locally. You know, we're talking about many years in the making. It's not something that can necessarily be turned around quickly. So absolutely local provisions. And the other thing that's been, you know, look, there are some positive sides to this story. There has been a lot of resilience and innovation through the pandemic that I think will hold us in good stead in the future. And one of those things is a lot more collaboration and cooperation across borders, across states. whether it be amongst retail teams themselves, you know, sharing their own product where there might be a short supply in one state or one area, they are, you know, getting that quickly to mm-hmm. their team, and even, you know, not just within retail teams of the same organisation, but, you know, there's been a lot of collaboration and cooperation to make sure that things were streamlined. And I think about the Victorian lockdown as a particular example of that. You know, when there was, in the beginning of the first lockdown, there was just a huge shutdown in the ports. There was a lot of product that was trapped in the ports at that point. And, you know, a new awareness of the dependence that we had on Victoria for a lot of that distribution. And that retailers navigated that extremely well. And I think they learned from that. And there's been a high degree of collaboration domestically, to answer your previous question, not necessarily in creating product, but certainly in sharing product around to make sure that
it's interesting, isn't it, though, Fleur? Because there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, pretty, I mean, reflexively, I suppose, people have said, oh, well, you know, here we go. It just goes to show we should make more stuff in Australia. Well, you know, this is all very well to say this, but we have spent, you know, 20 or 30 years or 40 years, of course, deciding that the world's great manufacturing place would be China, which is, as a result, exported low inflation because things have been cheap. And I know when sanitizer, of course, was in short supply, we have no problem in making sanitizer, but of course, no one in Australia makes the little pumps that go on top of the bottles because all those little things, that little plastic thing at the top, is made in China. So we don't make that here. So it's not as though we can simply turn this on again easily, can we? Or not? And I'm sure, I don't know, interested in your comment, whether we ought to be doing it either.
Well, I think it's market, you know, it is market driven and necessities the great mother of invention. So I think when that, you know, when that high need is there, you know, if we do have the tap turned off in particular areas, I'm sure the market will emerge, but it won't emerge overnight. You know, these things do take time to get, you know, a sort of a manufacturing chain happening. And of course it will take great government collaboration. And it is an area that the federal government's been focusing on quite significantly. There's a lot of grants in the manufacturing space. So if that need does arise in particular areas, I think it would have to be looked at in strong collaboration with the federal government in particular.
Just back on AdBlue, Marvin says, AdBlue and urea, by the way, which Fleur mentioned at the beginning, AdBlue is made from urea and there's a urea shortage because there's an LNG shortage, says Marvin. AdBlue affects not only trucks, buses too, and also emergency backup generators in hospitals. Sorry, Michael, you were going to say?
Just on that, well, if urea comes from LNG comes from Australia, and somehow the urea seems to be made in China. So it's an example of products, you know, going around the world when maybe they don't need to.
Where are all the pallets, Michael?
Indeed. Probably in the containers that are sitting in the port.
It's a high value question.
Yeah.
Where do you think they are, Fleur? Yeah.
They've got product on them. I think they're just being used, really. Yeah.
They're sitting in warehouses with stuff on them. Waiting.
Absolutely.
Actually, the point I did want to make was that I think one thing in favour of producing more in Australia would be greater automation, because that reduces the dependence on cheap labour, which has been the driver of globalisation in the past. So I think there are a number of factors which may, I mean, well, shouldn't exaggerate, but may increase the extent of manufacturing in Australia.
Go on, Fleur.
The great challenge there also is it's the willingness, you know, for Australians to actually work in that space as well. And, you know, what we've seen through the pandemic with staff shortages is that there are certain jobs that Australians don't step forward to do. And so unless that changes, or we have an immigration policy that matches our manufacturing ambitions, that would be a big challenge for us, I think.
What do you think, though, Fleur? I mean, a bit back to the question that Michael raised, and I was going to raise with you anyway, which is, you know, have retailers tried to develop alternative supply chains to, you know, to be less dependent on these sort of logistics problems? In other words, local suppliers? Has there been, or is that just a pipe dream, do you think?
No, I think absolutely that would have been considered all the way through this puzzle, you know, through the last 2 years. Wherever there is a workaround, you can guarantee a retailer will be looking at it, because at the end of the day, they're there to solve problems, to put things in customers' hands, to build the brand loyalty, to make the sale. They will, you know, they'll look at any solution, and they've been really adaptive. So you can guarantee that that would have been considered. There's no reason why Australian retailers want or need to source product from overseas, except that it's either because it's a better price, you know, or it's a more efficient model, or it's a better quality product or a particular brand. But you know, if that can be matched locally and there's a demand challenge offshore, they of course would be looking at that local supply. I just think in many instances it's just not a developed market for those products that they might be trying to source.
What about air transport? This is no good for bulk supplies, Michael, but has that opened up opportunities for air transport? Because you get the sense that there aren't that many flights in the air either.
Clearly the pandemic hit air travel, which hits belly hold cargo. So that was a major reduction in capacity. But it's been boom time for freighters. So air freight planes have, there's been quite a lot of conversions of passenger planes into freight planes. And use of passenger planes to carry freight with no passengers in, so just put the cargo on the seats.
Back on the urea issue, Ben's a chemical engineer and has given us a call too. Hi, Ben.
G'day.
Tell us about urea and AdBlue.
Okay, the sole plant that manufactures urea on the east coast of Australia is Intertek Pivot's Gibson Island plant in Brisbane.
Tell us what urea is, Ben.
Urea is... it's derived from ammonia and carbon dioxide reacted together. So it's also widely used as a fertiliser because we need nitrogen to help crops grow. So a lot more urea is used actually as a fertiliser than it is in AdBlue.
Right.
You can also use other things like ammonia and ammonium nitrate as fertilisers. But the issue is that, yes, that sole manufacturing plant on the east coast of Australia in Gibson Island is being shut down.
Really? Why? Given the shortage, you'd think there'd be huge demand for urea.
Yes, there is. We are becoming increasingly dependent on imports. I have been very concerned about the loss of domestic oil refining capacity in Australia. We seem to be closing oil refinery after oil refinery.
We've only got two left, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, oil is absolutely critical to national security, but the federal government seems relatively unconcerned about that issue. We failed to learn our lessons from history. During World War II, the motto was everything for oil. You know, you cannot have an effective defence force without petroleum products. As we import almost all of our refined petroleum products these days, I believe you could bring our country to its knees very quickly. Speaking as somebody that has been very active in industry, I hate to say it, but the biggest impediment to industry in Australia is actually green tape. The amount of environmental approvals and the complexities of those environmental approvals, you need both state and federal approvals for major projects. The consultation periods are extremely onerous, extremely costly. Groups like the Environmental Defenders Office often challenge legality of approvals, and it's very, very costly for companies to defend those. They often have no recourse for costs because, you know, they'll have a $1 shelf company that launches legal action, and it costs, you know, not just money but time. And the reason that so much manufacturing is going overseas to, like, the mantra of globalization, it's all about natural competitive advantages. But the environmental standards in China don't exist, and they're nowhere near what we would tolerate in Australia, right?
No.
But we're happy to be beneficiaries of lower cost, but we're blind to the environmental impacts of the goods and services we all consume.
Sure, I think that's right. As we said, we've seem to have basically decided that we'll make China the low cost manufacturer, and it's exported low inflation as a result. Thanks, Ben. Thank you for the explanation on AdBlue and urea too. Tell me about shipbuilding, Michael. I mean, presumably, if there's a great shortage, then the shipbuilding industry must be going gangbusters too. Is it?
It is. At least as far as container carriers are concerned.
Mm.
So there has been a surge of orders for new ships, which is good news for South Korea and China.
Because they're the major world's major shipbuilders, aren't they?
Those are where the ships are built. What that means for the future, I think, is really interesting because, as we've talked about, you know, the slowing of the supply chain means you need more ships and more containers to move the same amount of cargo. Well, in a post-pandemic world, when we return to some sort of normality, you might expect the supply chain to speed up again. But by then, we will have a lot of new ships and new containers. So I think we're faced with an interesting prospect of too much capacity and falling freight rates. So we might go from a situation of extremely high freight rates to extremely low freight rates.
Mm. How are you seeing it from where you're sitting, Fleur? I mean, how are you seeing a way out of this?
Well, look, I think firstly we have to accept that it's a slow way out of this. So, you know, we're in it for at least, you know, another year of supply chain challenges, and there is patience and more planning, greater planning required. I think out of that, you know, will come some great local solutions, some innovation. We've seen some really positive changes through the pandemic in lots of ways. You know, if you look at what's happened with online shopping, for example, I mean, that's now baked in, and we've got people who weren't doing that previously now quite adept on a retail level and also as consumers. And that's a positive innovation. And I think we'll see something similar happen in regard to some of these challenges. There will be, you know, new systems put in place, better collaboration and communication, probably better pathways with government, a better understanding with government around what some of the issues are and how they can actually intervene to help, whether it be with ports locally or, you know, with overseas diplomatic issues and things that might need to be sorted out on a government-to-government level.
But from where you are, from a retail point of view, are you basically just waiting till the system fixes itself? Are you?
Look, retailers are great at workarounds, and, you know, I think it's fair to say that, I mean, we had some great concerns last Christmas about supply chain issues, and I think, you know, if you did a survey, you'd probably find that most Australians were okay. Like, they had to be patient, and they, you know, might have been disappointed in certain situations, but we got through it. And I think, you know, a large part of the reason we got through it is because retailers developed really good workarounds, and they will do the same this year. And I think we'll find that even though you're probably looking at about 10 additional issues in 2021 to what we had last year, overall we'll probably have generally have a happy group of customers because retailers find ways to work around the system and just make it work for the customer. So there'll be some permanent solutions that come out of that in terms of how things work. And I think we'll all have a much better understanding of, you know, what needs to happen to make sure that the ports and the plane services keep their costs down. You know, it's not sustainable to have that seven
no.
times.
No.
Have Australian port operators made a bundle over this period, Michael?
Not to the same extent as shipping lines, although of course some terminal operators are shipping lines.
Because that's right. I'm saying presumably if the freight rates are up seven times, I bet you port charges have also gone up, haven't they?
Well, there's a hierarchy of bargaining power. So the shipping lines have got most of it, and they can negotiate hard with terminal operators. Terminal operators then pass on costs to trucking companies. So they're at the bottom of the heap in terms of bargaining
power. So they're the price takers, in other words.
Yeah, so we have access charges and things like that being passed on from terminal operators to trucking companies. Mm.
Gee, it must be. I mean, if you're a retailer, though, Fleur, I'm thinking, you know, I know I can sell this stuff, but, you know, I'm looking out over the horizon, but I've got no idea when it's going to arrive.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, that's been their life for the last 2 years. It's getting worse in on some levels, but it was anticipated that we'd have a lot of these challenges. And I think, you know, to go back to your previous question, what we've done probably is spotlit a number of vulnerabilities within supply chains. And, you know, if you think about clothing, for example, yes, ultimately it may lead to retailers sourcing from different locations, whether that be domestically or overseas, in the medium term. It's not something they can just click their fingers and
do. Well, you can't turn these things on just like that, can you?
You can't, but you can build, you can de-risk it, you know, for the medium term and start looking at some alternative solutions so that you're not in that position of vulnerability again.
I think for, you know, 2 years out, I think new ships and new containers will come to the rescue. So I think
so what happens after that?
Well, I think the seven times increase in freight rates will go into reverse.
Right. And just before you go, Michael, you mentioned at the beginning, which I wanted to follow up with you too. This you say you hope some of the money they're making out of this, you know, goes into trying to get a more renewable, a more sustainable fuel source for ocean ships. This is one of the great bugbears, isn't it, for renewable fuels that aircraft, trucks and ships hard nuts to crack. I know that there's a lot of talk about hydrogen for trucks and perhaps for aeroplanes as well. What about ships, though? I mean, they use bulk diesel. What's their future?
As an intermediate fuel, LNG looks quite good because that's lower in CO2 outputs and it's definitely cleaner in terms of emissions. In the longer term, Maersk is betting on methanol.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you know, like E10 you put in cars, they're looking to put alcohol into the fuel and then eventually move it entirely to alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
But other shipping lines...
Where would they think they'd obtain all that methanol from?
Well, that's a very good question. The problem is if you get that from biomass, that then starts to interfere with food production. So there is a very live issue there. You can synthesize it. So you can take CO2 out of the atmosphere and you can chemically combine it to make methanol. So it can be synthesized, but that's quite energy intensive. So you start with green hydrogen and then combine it with CO2 from the atmosphere and make methanol that way.
How long does it take to build a container ship?
2 to 3 years.
That all? Is that all?
So that means the ones that are being ordered now will arrive in about 2 years' time. So I think there'll be a surge of capacity about the time that other things start to normalize. Hopefully the pandemic subsides. So I think there isn't really a capacity constraint looking forward. So I think the surge of cost in shipping and also, of course, the surge of prices price inflation that we've seen, I think it'll subside.
Okay. All right. Well, Fleur, it's terrific to have your expertise on it and Michael as well. All the best for Christmas. I hope whatever you ordered online arrives.
Well, not the sound of it. Thanks, Phil. And thanks, Philip. Happy Christmas, Phil and Fleur.
Likewise.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.